When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello there, Foo followers. Ben Johnson here, the host of the Kung Fu Movie Guide podcast, reminding you that if you would like to support this show, we have a donations link available. Any spare pennies you may have would be greatly received to help with the upkeep of this show, the website, the social media accounts, and so on. Simply head over to paypal.me/Kung Fu Movie Guide to donate whatever you can. And a huge thank you to any listeners who have supported us over the years. You have our gratitude. Okay, thank you, and on with the show.
Well, if you're really so determined to have a fight, then I'll oblige.
Hello there, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Foo followers around the world. Welcome to the Kung Fu Movie Guide podcast, episode 82. This is the third episode in our new season, season 7, and what a treat we have for Kung Fu movie fans today. This is a special tribute show dedicated to the martial arts movie star Jimmy Wong Yu, who died this year on the 5th of April 2022 at the age of 79. He was a hugely influential figure in the world of Kung Fu movies and Hong Kong action cinema in general, and one of the biggest stars at the Shaw Brothers in the 1960s. So it would seem utterly inappropriate if we didn't recognise his great film career and look back at his life in some way on this podcast. So to discuss his colourful life and career, I have two wonderful guests on the show today. We have Sam Deegan, a writer and film historian based in Philadelphia and a huge Kung Fu movie fan. She's done audio commentaries and contributed to releases from Arrow and 88 Films and Vinegar Syndrome. She's a presenter of the cult film podcast Twitch of the Death Nerve. She's covered Wong Yu on that show before and also contributed an audio commentary to the 88 Films release of the classic 1970 Wong Yu film Chinese Boxer. And I am also joined by Frank Zheng. Frank is an Asian cinema expert, a former marketing manager at Tai Seng, which at the time was the largest distributor of Hong Kong movies in the USA. Based in San Francisco, Frank has also contributed lots to the world of audio commentaries. In the research for this show, I heard Frank's commentary on the Eureka Entertainment release of the excellent 1971 Wong Yu film One-Armed Boxer. And what fun we had, me, Frank and Sam, delving into the life and times of Jimmy Wong Yu. We don't shy away from the more, shall we say, controversial aspects of his life on this show, so hopefully for new and old fans alike, you should find the next hour or so quite entertaining. That is all coming up on today's show. That's coming up shortly. But before we get into that, a quick reminder that if you are enjoying the new season so far, then the best thing you can do is to leave us a star rating with your podcast provider. It takes about 2 seconds to do it, and it really does help to raise the profile of this show. You can also tell your friends about it, donate to the PayPal account, you can write a review, whatever you can do to help spread the good word of the Kung Fu Movie Guide. Head over to kungfumovieguide.com to read the latest martial arts movie reviews. That's also where you can sign up to our newsletter and get the chance of winning some cool Kung Fu movie related prizes as part of our monthly competitions. You can also find all of our contact details there if you want to reach out and get in touch. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Kung Fu Movie Guide, and we are also on Twitter at KF Movie Guide. And if you really want to go into a lot more detail, then you can send me an email. The email address is hello@kungfumovieguide.com. Okay, it's time to talk Jimmy Wong Yu. When I was editing this one, I realized that despite this being a Kung Fu movie podcast, we haven't really done an episode like this yet where we look back over the life of one of the genre's biggest stars. So I do hope this encourages you to seek out and watch more of Wong Yu's great work. You can find a list of his films on our Jimmy Wong Yu profile page on our website, kungfumovieguide.com, and I'll be sure to add a link to that page in the podcast description, plus a few reviews of some of my favourite Wong Yu movies. And I will be back at the end of this conversation to say a few more words and also share some more links which might be of interest. But until then, here is my chat with Sam Deegan and Frank Zheng discussing the life of Jimmy Wong Yu. Should we do some introductions? Sam, do you want to just sort of introduce yourself and maybe talk a little bit about some of the work that you do, and obviously being a fan of this guy that we're talking about today?
Yeah, sure. So I am a writer. I do a lot of audio commentaries for different companies like Arrow and 88 Films and, you know, Vinegar Syndrome. And I'm U.S.-based in Philadelphia, and, you know, I sort of grew up loving Shaw Brothers, and that's what led me to Wang Yu's work, and, you know, it's just so wild and incredible. I think it's hard not to just become obsessed with him once you start watching his films.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Sam. And Frank?
Well, you know, I originally worked at Taizeng Entertainment, which was, you know, the largest distributor of Hong Kong programming in the U.S. A few years ago, I was approached by Eureka, who was asking for permission to reprint some of the liner notes that I wrote for the Taizeng Laserdisc releases. And then they asked me whether I'm interested in doing audio commentaries for some of the upcoming releases. And, you know, I did a few commentaries back in my Taizeng days. So I thought, okay, I'll try to do them again. So I did a couple for Eureka, and then I guess they liked it. And then they started asking me to do more. And then other labels started approaching me, you know, Arrow and 88 Films. And so that's how I kind of had this little, you know, renaissance in terms of my involvement with, you know, Hong Kong cinema or Asian action cinema in general.
The person we're talking about today then, so let's get this cleared up. First of all, I've always said Jimmy Wang Yu. I've heard Jimmy Wong Yu. I don't know. Frank, is there a correct pronunciation or what's...
Well, it depends on how you want to pronounce it in Cantonese or Mandarin. Cantonese, yeah, you know, would be Wong Yu, whereas in Mandarin it would be Wong Yu. Well, you know, he's from Taiwan. Oh, well, he's actually from Shanghai. So I think we should go by the Mandarin pronunciation, which of course should be Wang Yu.
There we go. We've got definitive answer on that then. So yeah. Jimmy Wong Yu died this year, 5th of April 2022. He died at the age of 79. I'm curious, what are your earliest memories, some of your favorite memories, maybe the first time that you remember seeing him on screen? Sam, can I start with you?
Definitely Master of the Flying Guillotine. Yes. Which is one of those, you know, I think there are certain films, especially if you're somebody who loves cult movies or loves a certain genre like action or horror, there are certain films that I think will just are so, you know, new to you that they'll just stick in your brain forever. And I want to say I was 13 or 14 and saw a really bad bootleg of that, but it's just so incredible that I was like, okay, I need to find out who all of these people are and what else have they done.
Frank, what's your earliest Jimmy Wong Yu memories?
Oh, it's definitely When I'm Swordsman.
Yeah,
I remember watching it on, I think, on television back when I was, you know, growing up in Hong Kong. They show clips of that film. And I remember seeing it, like, wow, and this guy is fighting with one arm. I thought that was pretty fascinating. Yeah. And then later on, of course, I found out more about his work in, like, Master of the Flying Guillotine, Chinese Boxer, and, you know, and of course, When I'm Boxer. And that's how, you know, I found out more about him. But I was actually more familiar with his triad background back then, more than his film background, because, you know, his... All his incident involving the triad was pretty much news, you know, like they were, you know, always talk about him and his problem, you know, with other people and his involvement in triads in the news. So in some ways, I knew more about his real life controversies than actually more of his, you know, like film career. Of course, his, you know, his marital issues too. You know, he has various girlfriends, and of course, he's, you know, fighting the streets. So in other words, I kind of like was more familiar with his personal private life than his, you know, filmography. And only later on, when I started watching more of his films, then I realized like the work that he did in films and all that.
When you talk about kung fu movies, people always, you know, they will immediately think of Bruce Lee, Jackie Chan, Donnie Yen probably as well, Jet Li. You know, they're the sort of the big names that really jump out. Jimmy Wong Yu doesn't necessarily immediately spring to mind. If you know your kung fu movies, then you'll be aware of his work. I'm just wondering, you know, now that he's passed, what sort of legacy do you think he actually does leave behind?
Yeah, it's a frustrating question, and I agree with you that I think especially English language audiences, like in the US and the UK, tend to gravitate towards those bigger name personalities like Jackie Chan and Bruce Lee. But I think a lot of the work that Blu-ray companies like 88 Films and Eureka are doing will hopefully introduce more action movie fans to him, because I think he's such a great performer. But to me, a lot of the important, like the importance of his legacy, it's not just, you know, his starring roles, but the way that he kind of made Chinese Boxer and left Shaw Brothers and wanted to do some innovative directing work and wanted to do different things with the camera and just has this off-screen legacy as well. So, you know, I think it's been hard for people to find a lot of these films, especially in decent quality. So I'm hoping that all of these new releases will change that, because his legacy is important. But I do think he is, unless you're somebody who's already really well-versed in Asian cinema and martial arts cinema, I do think he does kind of get overlooked.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, he tend to be overshadowed by, you know, Bruce Lee. He, you know, he was one of the stars that, you know, he was on the cusp of popularity with his, especially with Unboxer when it was released in the U.S. as a, you know, Chinese professional. But then Bruce Lee came along, you know, and kind of, you know, and Bruce Lee star, you know, shone so bright that he kind of really overshadowed, you know, Jimmy Wang Yu in terms of his recognition overseas. And also, I like Sam said, you know, many of his films were not in very good condition. In many ways, he kind of reminded me of Angela Mao. You know, Angela Mao also had this body of film work where a lot of the newer generations of martial art film lovers have never seen, or never even aware that she has made so many movies. Apart from her, you know, like most of the people knew her from Enter the Dragon because of her, you know, her that significant cameo she had. But little do people know that she's, you know, she has such classic films like in Hapkido, Lady Whirlwind, When Taekwondo Strikes. And the reason was because the, you know, the condition of those films are so bad, you know, the preservation of them is so horrible. So hopefully, again, with the recent, you know, remastering efforts by, you know, like Eureka and Arrow and 88 Film, they're, you know, both Jimmy Wang Yu and Angela Miles, you know, name would be more prominent now and people would know more about their body of work.
Born in Shanghai, 28th of March 1943. I've done a bit of reading. I've tried to do some research here into his early years and growing up in Shanghai. But, you know, what do we know about his early life?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a bit of a challenge when you're trying to do research on somebody who, as we've said, is not as big of a figure internationally as they should be, and you don't speak Mandarin or Cantonese, or don't read them in this case. And so I've been able to find out, I think, what probably a lot of his fans know at this point, just that, you know, he has this really fascinating background in swimming and different kinds of athletics and things that I would associate with his role in action movies later, like being really into car racing and learning street fighting. And yeah. I think it comes through so clearly in his roles yeah. versus having the kind of like Chinese opera school background that some of the other bigger stars do. It just makes his fighting style seem more realistic.
He's referred to as a Taiwanese star in the sense that obviously I know he eventually settled and relocated to Taiwan, but he was born in Shanghai. He's a mainland Chinese star. So Frank, what do you know about his early life and his upbringing?
Well, yeah, like you say, he was born in Shanghai. His real name was actually Wang Jingquan. You know, not Wang Yu, but actually you know, Wang Jingquan's real name. And his father was a businessman in Shanghai. And so he actually had a pretty well, you know, well-off background. You know, his family well-off. They're not poor. You know, they actually have some money. But he was like a rebel from the very start. You know, he was growing up as a kid, he's always been like the troublemaker. He likes martial arts, but he always get into fights. You know, always got into fights with other kids. So he actually kind of became this sort of like a well-known little bully, you know, in the streets of Shanghai. And so his dad sent him to the Shanghai Sports Academy to, in hopes of, you know, getting him off the, you know, off the trail to become this gangster or what have you, or just this, you know, kid who's constantly getting into trouble. And because he's so active, he's so, you know, he's so energetic. So once he got into the Shanghai Sports Academy, he started learning, you know, martial arts and swimming. And that's how he, you know, became this guy with this pretty, you know, good physique, you know, muscular, you know, athletic physique. And in 1961, and this was during the time when China is going through all these, you know, political turmoil, right? You have the so-called Big Leap Forward in the 50s. And this, of course, is on the edge of the Cultural Revolution, in the 66. So there's this trend of like migration to the South, leaving basically the Northern side, getting the South, and especially to Hong Kong, you know, similar to like my parents. My parents went to Hong Kong in the early 60s. And so it's kind of like a similar situation. And so he went with his parents to Hong Kong in 1961. So that was like when he was around 16 or 17. And so that's why he got to Hong Kong, even though he was originally from Shanghai.
So he's in Hong Kong in the early 60s, and he's still into sports as an athlete. As you say, he picked up martial arts as well as an interest. Do we know where this acting theatrical side of him came from? Do we know any details around what would have sparked, you know, an interest in the arts?
So he went to Hong Kong. He went to the Zhuhai Academy for, you know, school. So it's kind of like a, you know, so a community college, so to speak, right? And at that time, this was the beginning of the popularity in martial arts films. Even though, you know, this is early 60s, you already have those black and white, you know, Cantonese films, which of course they had martial arts films as part of the genre. You have the Quan Tak Heng, Wong Fei Hung series. You have, you know, like films like Buddha's Palm. And at that time, the Mandarin-speaking martial art film weren't as popular yet. But the Hong Kong film industry folk want to expand their, you know, their reputation. They want to expand their scale to Mandarin-speaking countries or places like Taiwan, Southeast Asia, you know, like Malaysia, Singapore. They all speak, you know, Mandarin. And of course, eventually they want to go to China. And so they knew that to achieve that, they have to start making Mandarin-speaking martial art films. And so they start, like Shaw Brothers, who at that time was already making films, you know, the Wong Mei Tiao musicals, the drama, and what have you. So they started making martial art-speaking Mandarin films. They decided to, like, put ads in newspapers saying, we're looking for Mandarin-speaking male actors or in athletes who can speak Mandarin. And so, persuaded by his friend Wang Yu, decided to go and apply for it. And because of his experience, because of his, you know, knowledge in martial arts, And because he can speak, you know, Shanghainese, he can speak Cantonese. I mean, he learned Cantonese, like, you know, once he went to Hong Kong, and he can speak Mandarin, of course. And because of his physique, you know, his athletic physique, he was actually, you know, he kind of came ahead among more than 3,000 applicants that apply for this position, these, to be a male leading actor for Shaw Brother Mandarin speaking martial art film. And so Shaw Brother hired him.
Have you ever seen the wonderful picture that supposedly is from one of his early auditions, and it has him and Lole together looking like they're, you know, 20-year-old babies?
No, I haven't. No,
I've not seen that.
It's great. I'll have to find it and send it to you.
So Jimmy Wong Yu signs for Shaw Brothers in 1963. Shaw Brothers had a monopoly, didn't they, essentially, not just over Hong Kong cinema, but they were producing movies that were being shown, you know, across the Chinese diaspora, wasn't it? So Singapore, Taiwan as well. They were essentially, you know, the only game in town.
Yeah, and I think they had such, at least to me, such a fascinating approach to thinking big, I guess you could say. Like, they didn't, it seemed like they weren't really all that interested in just making, you know, local films or films that appealed to just a Hong Kong audience, but went into it really early on with this idea of not only being able to spread their kind of film network through Southeast Asia, but also really early on seemed to be fixated on how to bring it to a more international audience and how to get into like European festivals. And so that kind of expansion and that idea of, you know, how can we find a successful formula that appeals to a lot of people seems to have been really important in those like mid-60s films where they were sort of trying to find their niche.
Yeah, because they want to dominate basically first the Mandarin speaking martial arts film market so that they can, you know, be like the leading distributor of these films in, you know, Mandarin speaking countries like, you know, Southeast Asia, Taiwan, and eventually China. I mean, China is probably, you know, of course, the Cultural Revolution kind of ruined that plan.
Yeah.
Ruined that plan. You know, remember that Sir Run Run Shaw was actually recruited to go back to Hong Kong and, you know, took over administration of the Shaw Brothers because his brother wasn't doing that well of a job. and because he is kind of like, you know, he's educated, he's aware of the Western, you know, he admired Hollywood, you know, he loved the Hollywood system, he loved Hollywood film. So to him, he always wanted to make Shaw Brothers into the so-called Dongfang Hollywood, you know, the East Hollywood, you know, the Hollywood of the East, so to speak. Mm. So they always have this ambition of, you know, growing beyond just Hong Kong, and first, you know, first to the Southeast Asian, you know, Mandarin speaking country, and then of course to the rest of the world.
I know who you are, you bastard. Your time has come, then your son.
So we've got a young Jimmy Wong Yu, he's 20 years old, he's just signed for Shaw Brothers, and he's getting roles as an actor. Sort of a lot of early roles are kind of bit parts, aren't they? Extras, stunt work, that kind of thing. And he appears in a few movies, but it only really kicks off for him once he starts working with Chang Chieh.
Yeah, that's how it seems. And I can't imagine that that was something that sat very well with him, that sort of like 64, 65 period where he was just in smaller roles. But yeah, his career did take off pretty quickly. And I think him having that really headstrong personality, like naturally being kind of cantankerous, like Frank was saying, mm-hmm. I think that's probably what helped propel him forward so quickly, but ultimately, you know, led to his break with them because he didn't want to be contained.
Yeah.
I mean, Tiger Boy was the role that made him, you know, really took off in the Shaw Brothers, you know, while he was in Shaw Brothers. I mean, so in a way, you can say that, yeah, Chang Chieh is kind of like his earliest mentor.
Yeah,
and because he kind of, you know, he was so outstanding in Tiger Boy that kind of really jump-started his career, you know, as this one of the leading men for Shaw Brothers.
So Tiger Boy's 1966. So then, of course, the big movie that really establishes him as, you know, it's probably Hong Kong's biggest, you know, action star of the time is One-Armed Swordsman. So that's 1967, directed by Chang Cheh. This is a wonderful film. What you were saying, Frank, this was your earliest memory of seeing Jimmy Wong Yu on screen then was One-Armed Swordsman. What do you think is so captivating and so great about this movie, which was a huge success, the first Hong Kong film to gross $1 million Hong Kong dollars at the box office?
Well, for one thing, you know, people have never seen a lead actor who can fight with one arm.
Yeah.
So that's start, you know, that's the main thing. And then also for me especially, it somehow reminded me a lot of Japanese films, even though it's obviously a very Chinese wuxia film. And then of course we knew that, you know, Wang Yi would become a big fan of, you know, all those Chambara films, you know, the Kurosawa Yojimbo, you know, those samurai swords playing Chambara films. But it gave me a very distinctively Japanese feel to it, you know, with him being this one-armed guy fighting. And it just stood out, you know, it's just so different from your typical swordplay film at that time, where the lead actors doing the sword playing, the sword fighting, were not really martial artists. And so, like, the way they fought was more like ballet, you know, and it's more like the stage, almost very theatrical in the way they fought with the sword. But with Wang Yi, you saw him using his sword, and not just because, in addition to him just fighting with one arm, you can sense that he's really fighting. It's almost like it's almost like a really personal interpretation of a real martial artist that we grow, you know, like we all, kids like us in Hong Kong, we all grew up reading, you know, martial art novels by, you know, Kulong and you know, Louis Cha. And to be able to see someone fighting like what we read in the martial arts novel, that was really kind of refreshing. It's almost like kind of like a dream come true. It's like, oh yeah, you know, this is how it looked, you know, visually from how we imagined it while reading the novels.
Yeah, it's like the Marvel's Avengers of its time, isn't it, really, in many ways, yeah. Sam, I'm curious, what do you make of, I love these films he made with Chang Cheh. I think they're some of Chang Cheh's best films as well, those early Wuxia Shaw Brothers films. So The Assassin, Gone Swallow, Return of One-Armed Swordsman as well. It's just this sort of streak that they had working together is really remarkable. But, I mean, do you agree with that? I know, you know, Chang Cheh's career is an interesting one, isn't it? So I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on this period of films?
Oh, I think it's wonderful. I mean, yeah. I love Chang Cheh. He is an endlessly fascinating director. But I think definitely what Frank was saying is true for me as well, in the sense that, like, while I love the more operatic, balletic wuxia films, because I'm interested in that style of performance too, I definitely, growing up, wasn't as much. Like, it's something that I sort of had to learn to appreciate. And so seeing somebody with this more realistic fighting style who looks like he's really making an effort, like, I think in a lot of the later Shaw Brothers movies, especially like those Venom Mob films, they make it look so effortless. And so there's like less at stake. Whereas anytime Wang Yu is fighting someone, it looks like it could be the last fight, which I think brings just such a different energy to some of those earlier Shaw Brothers films that he's in. But I also, out of all of those, for some reason, really have taken to Return of the One-Armed Swordsman, which, for anyone who hasn't seen it, has this whole incredible plot where all of these sort of super villains who want to be the, you know, the lord of the martial world, they all have these great different gimmicks, and it's so cartoonish and stylized. And then there's Wang Yu, who's just brooding, and he doesn't want to get back into fighting. And it just, I think, kind of epitomizes what's great about his work with them.
Well, yeah, and also I think it's his rebellious character that you can see through his characterization. You know, I think he's trying to bring his own personal experience into his acting, you know, him being this rebellious guy who's always going against the rules, going against the norm, you know. And also, earlier I mentioned how, like, he, you know, like his work in One-Armed Swordsman reminded, you know, like us who read martial arts novels, of the novels that we read, and the one, you know, like he, you know, him being this one-armed guy is really almost like the same character in Louis Charles in The Condor Hero, you know, who of course is also eventually had his arm cut off later on in the novel. But I think him being this rebellious character is really resonates for a lot of the young people growing up, especially in Hong Kong at that time, because remember, this film came out in 1967. That's during the height of the Hong Kong riots.
Yeah.
If you know a little bit about the history of the riots, and it started as this protest against, you know, the fare increase of the ferry, which the pro-communist people in Hong Kong, the pro-communist underground folks in Hong Kong, kind of took advantage of it and stirred up emotions again, you know, among all the younger people who were like disenchanted with, you know, the low wages, the lower living condition. And so he kind of represented those folks, the Hong Kong youths that are against society. And I think that's the main reason for his overnight success.
This is where you start seeing that concept of Wong Yu as this lone hero who will, you know, is willing to put his own life on the line. And a lot of these films do end with a defiant death scene, you know, the heroic death. But that the traits that you then see throughout his career, they're all established during this time period, aren't they, Sam? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. And I think he, in a lot of these films, he seems to wind up not wanting to fight and being very sort of stubborn and resistant about not just engaging in battle like so many other martial artists in these films do for the glory of it or for some sort of name or renown. And he also, like things like in Chinese Boxer, he winds up fighting gangs who are greedy and who are just trying to exploit the local population, which I'm sure ties into what Frank was saying about the riots and the situation at the time where people were tired of feeling exploited.
One man against ruthless killers trained in the arts of judo. Lethal kicks. Karate. Kendo. Don't miss the Hammer of God. It's wild, explosive. It's coming soon, the Hammer of God.
Chinese Boxer, 1970. So this is his debut as writer, director, and star. Now, there was controversy about this at the time because he was pitching this film. I believe this is correct. He'd been pitching this film for a while to Run Run Shaw and both Chang Che, and they both told him, stick to what you know. You know, you're a wuxia hero. You know, this is a tried and tested formula. You're a huge success, a huge star in Hong Kong. He was like, no, this is Chinese Boxer, an empty hand kung fu movie. This is the direction that we need to go in. And his stubbornness sort of won out in the end. Frank, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he, you know, by then he was watching other films from other countries, like mainly from Japan.
Yeah.
And he saw how, you know, he saw a lot of the Japanese film incorporate, you know, like karate. He realizes that, you know, like in Japan, for instance, their so-called action film were not just about sword, you know, it's just not chambara film. There's also hand-to-hand fighting. And also he likes the fact that he likes the fact that there's this conflict, you know, the idea of having, like, you know, conflict between China and Japan. And then, which of course led to the different, you know, like the different, the differences between the Chinese and Japanese kung fu.
Yeah.
And so he felt, well, why can't we do this? Why can't we do a combination film where we can showcase all these different style of fighting? And so, like you said, you know, both Run Run Shaw and Chang Che were against that idea. Yeah, he tell them to stick with swordplay. You know, swordplay. This, you're good at swordplay. This is what you're famous for. This is what people like. stick with it. But you know, he was persuasive. He was persistent. So finally, they were saying, okay, we'll let you make this one film. You know, but if this film, you know, if this film fail, you're going back to Sword Play. And of course, this film became a hit.
Yeah, huge success. Completely transformed the industry, Sam, didn't it? Because there wasn't, this is credited as the first sort of empty hand kung fu movie. This predates, you know, Bruce Lee by a good year or so, doesn't it? So, you know, it really is, Jimmy Wong Yu really is the forerunner for the modern kung fu film, essentially.
Yeah, and it's ironic because after the success of Chinese Boxer, Chang Cheh goes on to make more films that have this kind of realistic, edgier street fighting feel to them. And in a way, I mean, I know we were talking at the beginning of the episode about how it's frustrating that Wong Yu doesn't have the kind of reputation of people like Bruce Lee and Jackie Chan, because, you know, as you pointed out, he kind of kicked off this whole wave. But I think in a way, to me, it sort of signifies, and granted this would be a while coming, but it sort of signifies the beginning of the end for Shaw Brothers, because I think it really is symbolic of their resistance to embrace any kind of change, to give their stars room for creativity, which of course is what caused a lot of people to decamp and go to Golden Harvest, where they were given more options to make different kinds of films that would appeal to younger audiences.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, there were several reasons for him leaving Shaw in such spectacular fashion, or such fiery fashion, which I'll go into detail later on. Well, for one thing is, right before Chinese Boxer was released, Sir Run Run Shaw's, at that time, I guess you can call her a mistress, Mona Fong became one of the higher-ups at Shaw. And so, and then, of course, they got married. And so Shaw became this kind of like a husband and wife team. And they kind of took over the administration, which, as a result, led to one of their founding, you know, person, Raymond Chow, being ignored or put to the side. And so he decided to leave Shaw and start his own company, which, of course, we all know led to Golden Harvest. And so when Raymond Chow left Shaw and started Golden Harvest, he started, you know, he brought his own, you know, like a chef leaving a restaurant to go to another restaurant, right? So Raymond would not leave by himself. He would bring his, like, own, you know, his close team of advisor or whatever, you know, partners with him. And so he's trying to persuade Jimmy Wong Yu to go with him. And even though at that time, Jimmy Wong Yu's salary at Shaw, and remember, they're all, you know, they're all contract actors, right? So they're all, you know, these are all, you know, remember, Shaw's like assembly line way of running things. So all the actors, you know, a contract actor, they're signed to Shaw for like 10 years, what have you, and you know, they have this set salary. You know, so it's not like, not just because they're famous doesn't mean their salary is going to be, you're going to see a huge leap for the next film and so forth. So anyway, so at that time, even though Wong Yu was not satisfied with how stingy Shaw Brothers was to him, or to his way of making films, but because his contract, he signed an 8-year contract with Shaw. And so at that time, you know, his contract has not expired. So he, you know, technically he couldn't leave yet. So what he did was he would sneak in. He's sneaking to the Shaw Brothers, I guess, file cabinet or their offices. And he, you know, took out like over 100 contracts and burned them all. So he burned all those contracts. Right. And, you know, he stole his own contract. And to make sure that there's no traces left behind, so he burned, like, these are not his contract. These are the contracts for, like, more than hundreds of other actors. And so he just burned them all. And then he left for Golden Harvest. And
wow. That's going out in style.
Going out in style. So this is 1971, right? So 1971. And because he left and went to Golden Harvest, Shaw Brothers decided that they're not going to heavily promote the Chinese boxer. But then it still became like the number one box office, you know, in Hong Kong at that year, which actually also led to the eventual making of King Boxer.
Yeah.
Right. It was the success of a Chinese boxer that led to Shaw Brothers making King Boxer with Lo Lei.
And it's fascinating, isn't it, Sam, what happened with Chan Che, as you mentioned, because then when he loses his big star, he then, you know, has a new generation of actors who he then works with, you know, repeatedly, Ti Long and David Chang, Chen Quan Tai, then Fu Sheng as well later. So it's interesting, isn't it? But then he steps into Kung Fu movies as well. That was the path that he then eventually took as a director as well.
And my favorite sort of back and forth spat throughout the 70s is the rival one-armed swordsman movies where you have you have David Chang in one, you have all of these like unofficial sequels, except No Wait, it is the official sequel. And I think that rivalry kind of led to this whole subgenre of one-arm warrior movies, which, like, to imagine that there would be not just one one-armed sword fighter or one-armed boxer movie, but, like, a dozen of them or probably 20 of them is just wild.
Yeah. It's its own subgenre in itself.
It's great.
So Jimmy Wang Yu, so this was part of the deal then, wasn't it? Was that because he broke his contract with Shaw Brothers, the deal was that he just couldn't work in Hong Kong again. That was the punishment.
Yeah, they kind of settled. Initially, Run Run Shaw didn't want to do any actions towards Wang Yu. And finally, it's realizing that they're losing talent left and right to, you know, Golden Harvest, that they decided to kind of cave in and use this excuse of, okay, we're going to raise salary of all our contractor actors. And so they re-signed, you know, so the Shaw re-signed contracts with all of their actors under their wing. And then they filed a lawsuit against Wang Yu for breaking the contract. They finally settled. He actually only got compensated for like $5,000 Hong Kong, which was like nothing. You know, we're talking about like say less than almost like $700. But then the condition, of course, like you say, is he can never make films in Hong Kong again. Mm. You know, so which is why he went over to Taiwan.
Combine the Dirty Dozen with the Magnificent Seven, and you have the Chinese Professionals, Kung Fu Beast. Siamese devils, Tibetan tiger man, the invincible Yuga Khan, the one-armed boxer. A total of 9 masters of the martial arts to tear the screen apart. The Chinese Professionals. Rated R.
In Taiwan, he was able to really flourish as a filmmaker and create the kind of films that he wanted to make, both as the star and the producer and the director of these movies as well. Sam, just looking at his 1970s work when he's working in Taiwan, there's some really great titles throughout the 70s there. Are there any favorites of yours that he works on during this period?
I mean, I think definitely Frank has mentioned a couple times the influence of Japanese cinema on his films. And I think when he's out from under Shaw Brothers' thumb, you start to see more and more of that. And something like Beach of the War Gods, which is from 73, is one of my personal favorites because it seems like he's kind of trying to do his own Akira Kurosawa movie. And like the sheer number of people on screen for most of the film, I think the way that at least I think about some of the more egotistical actors who go off and want to direct their own movies, sometimes it's okay. A lot of the time it's a disaster because they don't have directorial experience. But I think he proved pretty quickly, even with some of those shots in his early films like Chinese Boxer, where you get the sense that he's pushing for different kinds of shots and sort of sequences than you would see in a standard Shaw Brothers movie. You get the sense that he's learning on every single film and taking all of these chances that wind up being really fascinating.
Like Sam said, especially for combining like his style was like the Japanese style continue, you know, the moment he went to go to Harvard, remember he made Sachiuichi versus One Armed Swordsman.
Yeah, yeah. So we should mention that as well, because that's really early, just as he leaves Shaw Brothers. So that's 1971. He goes to Japan and makes that Zatoichi movie, reprising his most famous role of One Armed Swordsman. But he was always looking for international collaborations as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, and it's interesting because the first time I saw that film, I expected that maybe there would be more tension between the One-Armed Swordsman and Zatoichi, but it really is kind of a movie where Zatoichi has to rescue him. And you get the sense that he just is so excited for this collaboration to be happening. And yeah. It's an amazing film. I mean, almost all of the Zatoichi movies in their own way are, but the dynamic is fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. Is there an alternate? There's two different endings to that movie, though, is there?
Yes.
Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But just like Godzilla versus King Kong, right? You have to satisfy, you know, like both groups of audiences. You have an ending where Godzilla won and then the other ending where King Kong won. So it's same here.
Yeah. Yeah. And Sam, you touched on this earlier. I think it's important, obviously, to stress that, you know, during the 70s, this is the period of Bruce Lee. And although Jimmy Wang Yu wasn't necessarily the most gifted of martial artists on screen, you do start to see other techniques creeping into his films, other gimmicks, whether it be really outlandish characters. I'm thinking immediately of One-Armed Boxer, and Long Fei's got those weird Dracula teeth. Not too sure why. It's never explained, which is something I love. So that's what makes him such an interesting kung fu movie filmmaker, isn't it? Is all these little tricks and things that he puts into his movies.
I think, though, he was also not reluctant to highlight the talents of other performers. I mean, something like Man from Hong Kong has so many incredible martial arts in it. I mean, a very young Sammo Hung gets the crap beaten out of him in the first 20 minutes of the movie.
Yeah. Frank, what are the movies for you during this period? Because they do get more and more sort of nutty, don't they, I guess, as the 70s go on. Do you enjoy this period of his work?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's like, to me, like he's almost like everything but the kitchen sink and the kitchen sink. Yeah. Like especially in One Armed Boxer, where you have all these different fighters, right? You have the llamas, you have karate, you have judo, you have Indian, you have Thai kickboxing. It's almost like he's like Sam said, he's not afraid of giving the spotlight to other people in the film. His main idea, I think, has always been to entertain entertain the film goers. It's almost like, I want you to get your money's worth by coming to see my film. I mean, like, when I'm boxing, it's just all these fights, especially in the middle sequence, you know, when you thought that, oh, this is going to be over, the fight continues. So it's really entertaining. And even though you do have some campy element, like, you know, like Sam said, the villain with the fangs and the little comedy with the llamas, you know, inflating llamas and stuff. But I think in the end, he just wanted to, you know, entertain folks. But in a way, it could be one of the reasons why he was overshadowed by Bruce Lee, I think, because somehow some of these elements in his film that somehow make the film less serious than it should be. Whereas you look at the Bruce Lee film, like The Big Boss and Fist of Fury, it's all serious, right? Even the comedy is not as outrageous or not as like slapstick. And so I think somehow it was because of Bruce Lee's seriousness in his films, and also his idea of Bruce Lee kind of took this theme of this everyday folks going against, you know, the bad guy, they're going against other external forces, you know, one step further, especially in Fist of Fury, where, you know, he's stirring up all these, you know, patriotism with the Japanese, you know, and setting it in the era right before the Japanese invasion. I think that kind of struck a nerve among the audiences. Mm. And I think that's why somehow eventually Bruce Lee's success kind of overshadowed, you know, Wong Yu's.
Jimmy Wong Yu is the man from Hong Kong. A furious arsenal of martial arts. With his sights set on smashing organized crime. Nobody's safe from the man from Hong Kong.
Curious as to how his star... did it continue to shine throughout the 70s? I mean, he would have then started facing pretty stiff competition once Jackie Chan and the kung fu comedy trend started taking off in the late 70s. So I'm just curious as to how his fame was affected after the move to Taiwan. Do we know much about that?
My understanding of his sort of public acclaim or public attention in the 70s is almost less about his films, unless you're interested in, you know, like the drive-in market and grindhouse films and cult movies, and became more about his public persona and, you know, being part of a triad and almost killing someone in a restaurant.
I've heard this story. Do we know much about this?
It almost reminds me of, you know, if you are familiar with the U.S. rap scene in the 90s, where you have these sort of coastal rivalries, people getting into shootouts with each other, and it's like you hear about their name associated with the fight, but you don't get many details. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure Frank knows more about this, but my understanding is there's this huge fight at a restaurant. Someone died. Jimmy Wang Yu was there, but nobody could conclusively tie him to it enough to arrest him. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there were actually several instances. So in 1976, you know, he was drinking wine or drinking beer at this restaurant, and he wanted to bring one of the girls who worked there. They wanted to take her out. And he felt like she wasn't giving him face. A rival triad group was there, and so that's how they started this huge fight in the corridor of the restaurant. And then Wang Yu actually have to escape to Hong Kong to avoid being investigated for the incident. In 1980, he was, you know, he offended a gang leader at a casino. And so while he was dining at the restaurant, he was actually, you know, he was actually attacked by the rival gang members, and he almost died, you know.
I mean, it's, you know, what a amazing life. The stories, what a life, I know.
His life is like a movie. I'm not going to directly come out and say that someone needs to make a Jimmy Wong Yu film, because I feel like I could see that going very badly and just being a terrible film, but... Yeah. It's just so cinematic. Also, this idea that Frank mentioned of people giving or not giving each other face. I think when I first started watching Hong Kong movies, that is one of those concepts that is a little bit hard to translate. And so when you'd see it in subtitles, you're like, what? What about his face? But it's so crucial to understanding any of those crime films.
What's this story then about him helping Jackie Chan getting out of the low-pay contract?
Well, he became good friends with Jackie. When Wang Yi left, go to Harvard in the mid-70s, he actually worked with, you know, cooperated with Lo Wei. They were doing independent films at that time. And then that's how he met Jackie, with the Killer Meteors and all, you know, the, all some of these films. So when Jackie tried to get out of the contract with Lo Wei, Wang Yi used his, you know, when he couldn't do it, Jimmy, you know, Jim Wang Yi kind of helped him get out of his contract Lo Wei so that Jackie can go to Harvard. And to pay him back for his gratitude, Jackie, of course, starred in his film, you know, Fantasy Mission 4 and Island of Fire. So, you know, so that's kind of like his thank you to Jimmy for helping him out at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. He appeared in these sort of comeback films, I guess, throughout, you know, one in the 80s. Yeah. Fantasy Mission Force, which is a completely nuts film. But it's interesting, I guess, the power that he still had over the film industry, that he could, you know, this is Jackie Chan in the 80s. You know, he's a huge star, that he would still have the power to entice someone of that stature to make a movie with him. So that says quite a lot as well, doesn't it, I guess?
Well, in some ways, he also kind of needed Jack to help him boost his box office successes in the 80s as well. Because, you know, his star was already kind of, you know, gradually fading by that time. And so, you know, he was trying to really make a comeback, you know, with you know, all these later 70s films, you know, particularly, you know, the Master of Fire and Guillotine. I mean, many people thought that, you know, Master of Fire and Guillotine was a huge hit, but not really, not in locally. You know, it was just, to them, it was just another kind of like a, you know, a typical martial arts film.
Yeah.
Which I don't understand at all.
Yeah, well, Taiwanese film traditionally hadn't do that well in Hong Kong to begin with. So, you know, they look at it as a Taiwanese film. They don't really look at it as a Hong Kong film. And then by the time he made the films in the late 70s and 80s, they weren't all doing well.
There were various relationships. I know that he was married in 1969, married the actor Jeanette Lin Choi, and they had three daughters together. And then he married again in 1981, a former flight attendant, Wang Kei-chen. It was quite a public divorce, that one, I believe. That was all over the press when that was happening. Is that correct?
I guess, yes. It was probably more of a news in Taiwan than in Hong Kong, I think. Yeah. Because by then, you know, the Hong Kong industry, you know, and Hong Kong entertainment industry really hasn't been, they really weren't paying that much attention to Wang Yi anymore. And by the late, we talk about he divorced her second wife in 1999. So that's like late 90s. So by then, people, The attention to Wang Yi has really faded in the Hong Kong industry. His first wife, Lin Choi, is actually the younger sister of Kenneth Tsang, who, of course, passed away recently.
Yes.
Lin Choi is her stage name. Lin Choi is her stage name, which is why it's not, you know, the last name was not Zhang, but she's actually the younger sister of Kenneth Tsang. His daughter, Linda Wong, was a pretty popular singer in Hong Kong, though.
Yeah.
So she was more, in a way, she's getting quite a little bit of attention in Hong Kong, but then it's not like people associate her with her being the daughter of Wang Yi.
Yeah, she's a star in her own right.
Right.
He comes from beyond time, from beyond the outer limits of your imagination. He's the master of the flying guillotine. And he's ready to blow your mind. With more nerve-shattering special effects than you have ever seen before. The master of the flying guillotine.
So he retires from the film industry 1997, but then he does make this comeback 2011. He appears in Wu Shao, also known as Dragon. He had a wonderful role in that film with Donnie Yen. Small role in the Guillotines, which was a sort of remake, I guess, of Flying Guillotine, the old Shaw Brothers movie. And Soul as well. So he makes a brief comeback. Now, Sam, have you seen these movies? And what do you think of him as an older actor coming back into the film industry? He's really very good, isn't he, as an actor in these movies?
Yeah, so I haven't seen Soul, but I think he really just has that same sort of force of nature charisma where they're just... is something about the way that he carries himself as a fighter and just as an actor that I don't think really diminished at all.
Frank, would you agree with that? When he made sort of brief comeback in the 2000s, you know, it was and it's great to just see him on screen again, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, of his last three films, I've only seen, you know, Wu Shao, of course.
Yeah.
The other two films are kind of hard to see outside of Taiwan. But yeah, I mean, he was great. He you know, remember that he retired in 1997 and became this kind of like a businessman. And then, you know, 14 years later, he's, you know, I guess he was either persuaded by Donnie or persuaded by the filmmakers to take on this role, you know, in Wu Shao. He was fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember it was quite news at that time, because the idea was, you know, people at that time, the perception was, oh, Jimmy Wang is going to start in kung fu films again, you know. Yeah. Because this first film of him coming back from retirement being a martial arts film. So there was actually kind of great anticipation in him coming back to this, you know, to the film industry. And of course, it earned him, you know, acting nomination at the Taiwan's Golden Horse Award for his performance.
And it was great, wasn't it, around that time, because I remember he was doing more events and he was being interviewed more. He became much more of a public in the public realm again, and as you say, getting lifetime achievement awards and that sort of thing. So that was really good to see him have a bit of a renaissance, I guess.
Yeah, it's great that he was able to get that lifetime achievement award a couple years before he died, because as we've been saying, you know, I don't really think he has gotten the credit that he's due, which is also why it's so great to hear people like Jackie speaking about him more publicly now.
Yeah, so we'll touch on that. So he did suffer, obviously, from ill health towards the end of his life. Had a mild stroke in 2011, a second stroke in 2016, and then he wasn't seen in public after that. Returned to Taiwan and passed away this year. So died on 5th of April. There was an announcement on Instagram by his eldest daughter, Linda Wong. Jackie Chan did write on social media, and he said, "The contributions you've made to kung fu movies and the support and wisdom you've given to the younger generations will always be remembered in the industry, and your movies will always remain in the hearts of your fans." So how do you think Wong Yu will be remembered? Because we're losing a lot of these great talented guys from the 70s who worked during the kung fu movie boom and the heyday. So, Sam, what do you think?
Honestly, I don't know if I can say how I think he'll be remembered, but I hope that he'll be remembered as a real pioneer of the genre. And something that I think is kind of fascinating is something I've heard more recently from cult movie fans who are maybe better versed in American and European films, who have already sort of watched a lot of them, seem to be discovering not just Japanese films and Hong Kong films, but specifically some of those kung fu movies, and they're just sort of blown away by them. Yeah. Like, I did a couple months ago for my podcast, we did an episode on Master of the Flying Guillotine, and the sheer number of people who hadn't seen it but watched it and were just blown away, it was like, yeah, you need to watch Wong Yu's films.
Yeah. Frank, what's your thoughts? Because obviously we know his controversies and his various you know other activities maybe threaten to overshadow his legacy in some ways, but how do you think he will be remembered?
I think his controversy is more indented in the minds of Asian, you know, in Asia more than overseas, because obviously a lot of the Western you know, fans of Wang Yi probably had no idea about his, you know, his rather more, you know, colorful private life. But I think, you know, he would be remembered for really two main things. You know, he was really the first martial arts, or, you know, star. You know, he was the first, you know, before, you know, he was the first, really the first star in the martial arts genre, you know, before Bruce Lee, before Jackie Chan. And he was the first person who really, like Sam said, pioneered, you know, not just hand-to-hand combat films, you know, with Chinese boxer, but also the fact that he was the first one to really combine different martial arts styles in his films. You know, before, you know, Chinese boxer was really just one style. Like most of the Hong Kong martial art film is always just like one style. You know, it's either sword play or you know, like mainly sword play, really, you know, at that time. But, you know, with Chinese boxer and then later on with the other film, he not only pioneered the hand-to-hand combat films, but also films that feature different martial art style, different, you know, not just from within China. No, you know, like we're not talking just about, say, Shaolin versus Wu Tang, or you know, or different, you know, schools of kung fu, but also different countries. You know, like, you know, style from different countries, karate versus judo versus Muay Thai. So yeah, he would be remembered for those two main things.
If people are looking for an introduction to his work, Sam, what are the movies they should be jumping into first of all if they just want to do a, you know, intro into Wong Yu's filmography?
I guess my couple would be One-Armed Swordsman, Chinese Boxer, Master of the Flying Guillotine, and Man from Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Those would be my same choices as well.
Yeah. Very good.
And I think The Man from Hong Kong is really, I mean, I think people, it is worth digging out. It's worth finding that film and watching it, because that was, you know, you can see that that's how, like, he's trying to be promoted as kind of like the James Bond of Asia, or the Chinese James Bond. It's almost like their way of trying to make him as big as Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
To all to make
well, that was that meant that was meant to be a Bruce Lee.
Meant to be
movie,
for Bruce Lee, yes.
Yeah.
Right. And all, it's kind of like their way to make up for him being overshadowed by Bruce Lee. And like you said, ironically, that film was originally meant for Bruce Lee. And but to me, it was. I mean, it's excellent film, you know, but it's also I think one of the most fascinating entities in his filmography. This the fact that, you know, you have him as this kind of like a Asia James Bond guy, doing his acting chops and also fighting
with some of the wildest like Bond parallel sex scenes that you will find anywhere.
And that theme song.
Great song.
Sky High, right? I think.
Sky High. Guys, thank you so much for doing this. This has been an absolute treat to talk with you today about Jimmy Wong Yu. You have a good rest of the day.
Thanks, Ben. Thank you.
Have a good night.
Bye.
There we go, Kung Fu Movie fans. I do hope you enjoyed listening to that. That was me and Sam Deegan and Frank Jeng, remembering the late Jimmy Wong Yu, who died in April of this year, 2022, at the age of 79. What an incredible life, I'm sure you will agree. What a great legacy of Kung Fu movies that he does leave behind. Sam did email me that photo after the call. It's a glorious black and white Shaw Brothers publicity shot featuring Wong Yu and Lo Lei and Cheng Liu, just looking so young and looking like absolute studs. I will be sure to share it over our social media channels and also on the page for this episode of the show on our website. One area of Wong Yu's life that we didn't cover here is the often told rumor that he was in the army prior to starting his film career. I think I've read that on pretty much every English language bio that I've could find of him on the internet, and we didn't cover it here because we're pretty sure that that actually isn't true. But if you do know otherwise, then do send me an email, by the way, hello@kungfumovieguide.com. Sam asked Frank after this call over email about Wong Yu's time in the army, and Frank said that it did sound like hearsay since he was supposedly in the Taiwanese army and not the mainland Chinese army, which is the PLA. Frank writes, I don't believe Wong Yu was in Taiwan before he went to Hong Kong from Shanghai, not that I know of anyway. So there you go, another myth busted. And as we discovered on this episode, there are many myths that do surround the life of Jimmy Wong Yu, so it is hard to know sometimes what is true and what is simply rumour. Anyway, all the rumours do still add to the colourful portrait of the man. A quick note also on alternate titles. You will have heard the American trailers of Wong Yu's films during that conversation. Now, the American names for kung fu movies in the 1970s were always so much more exciting. So, The Chinese Professionals is the American title for One-Armed Boxer. It sounds like that's probably a riff on the 1966 Western The Professionals, starring Burt Lancaster and Lee Marvin. And you heard a trailer for The Hammer of God. That's an extraordinary alternate title for the film Chinese Boxer. For more detail on those triad stories that Frank mentioned, I'll drop in a link to a very insightful article that I read on the blog Cool Ass Cinema. It's a very good blog, that. This article does shed a little bit more light on that aspect of Wong Yu's story. I will also throw in some musical links that were mentioned in that conversation. The theme for the 1975 Wong Yu movie, The Man from Hong Kong, which we mentioned at the end there, that was a Hong Kong Australia co-production. It also starred George Lazenby. Do go and check it out if you haven't seen The Man from Hong Kong. The theme song is called Sky High and it's by the band Jigsaw. Go and check out that video of that song with a singing drummer. Don't see many singing drummers anymore. It's always good to see. And for me, nothing screams 1970s kung fu movie more than the Big Boss theme by the Peter Thomas Sound Orchestra. You heard a little bit of that tune over the US trailer for The Chinese Professionals, aka One-Armed Boxer. So I've just added a link to that full track as well in the description. You can read our profile on Jimmy Wong Yu, plus many reviews of his movies on our website, kungfumovieguide.com. Sam Deegan is on Instagram and Twitter at Sam Deegan. She also has a Patreon account. You can go to patreon.com/Sam Deegan. And do check out her podcast, Twitch of the Death Nerve, available wherever you get your podcasts. Frank Jeng is also on Instagram at Frank Jeng. Both Frank and Sam are doing wonderful work in championing these classic kung fu movies across many gloriously remastered Blu-rays around the world. So please do pick up your copies as and when they land. These companies are doing great work in restoring classic kung fu movies and they're finally being shown the love, care and attention that they deserve. So hats off to the likes of Eureka Entertainment and 88 Films and Arrow Films and Vinegar Syndrome and all the other companies out there who are doing a sterling job. Finally, all it remains for me to say is a huge thank you to Sam and Frank for joining me on this episode, and a huge thank you as always to you, the loyal Foo follower, who has listened to this episode all the way to the very end. Thank you so much. I will be back in 2 weeks' time with another brand new episode of the show. But until then, please do take care, stay safe, be well, and I will speak to you all again very soon on the Kung Fu Movie Guide podcast. Bye for now.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.